Well, this is Pete Griffin calling from Juneau, Alaska. I'll be facilitating this session with Julianne Ryan. And I was reading Julianne's bio. Her career began at the age of 5 doing television commercials, where she learned some important lessons in life, like Teamsters eat first. She later went to an Ivy League school to validate her on-the-job learning. And I just love this. She learned to drop trendy psychological theories and trendy psychologists with alarming ease. So, with that, Jules, will you let's begin?
Well, thank you, and it's an honor and a pleasure to do this with you. How would you like me to start, Pete? Let's go with that.
Oh gosh, I think let's just jump right into it. The importance of being the other.
Okay. Well, the reason for the title is I, like many of us, I've been listening to a lot of news this last year or so and before that, and listening to the words, the cultural divide, racial division, we have to start a dialogue, we have to reach across the table. And I start to think about this expression kept popping into my head, which was the importance of being the other. And it's a shameless play on the words of one of my favorite authors and wits, Oscar Wilde. And the reason it kept popping into my head is I was thinking about how do we start to learn about people that are different than us, and how do we become aware, and how can we, as storytellers, you know, learn how to help others maybe broaden perspectives or change perspectives. So I've been doing a lot of thinking about that, and that really is what prompted the title. And one of the things I learned about was a lot of that learning happens not in big classrooms or lectures. It's in small places and like hallways and kitchens, and it's a lot of the small things that make a difference. So I'm going to jump in, Pete, with your permission, and you know, bell, the starting bell, so to speak, and start to share a couple of vignettes I put together that I pulled out of my memory bank that I want to share with everybody today, with the goal at the end of the story sharing that we share some conversations about some things that may have occurred in our lives and what we can do in our particular professions to help the conversations and get better communications going. So on that note, let me begin. Okay, when you listen to my stories, I'm going to ask you to come up with a visual and to visualize an old-time slide projection, one of those that would have the carousels, and you would hear this distinctive click when one slide was dropped in and viewed on the wall, and then another click as it moved forward. Because these are like postcards in my mind of memories that I've had since a kid. And to start off with the first one, what are you? The scene is 1970s, St. Nicholas of Tolentine Grammar School, Queens, New York. A group of kids suddenly swarmed around my best friend Elizabeth in the fourth grade section of the black tarred schoolyard. What are you? Are you black or white? Where are you from? And why is your hair so straight? And why are you talking so funny? We had all been in school together since the first grade, and suddenly Elizabeth's skin coloring and her appearance was of great interest. But the questions didn't feel like simple curiosity. They felt intense, like she had to get her answer right. And Elizabeth didn't look like anybody else. She didn't look like the African-American kids, and she certainly didn't look like the Irish and the Italians and the Hispanic kids. So while the group clustered around her, Elizabeth was being challenged to explain herself. And she stood next to me. Her posture tall, straight, anchored by a long black braid that drew a perfect line down her back. And she began to explain her background. But she did it quietly, calmly, patiently with these words. I am Haitian. So I'm going to move on to a road trip to the Heartland. I was about 11 years old, and my family was taking a summer family car trip through the Heartlands and stopped in a small town for the night. We had been exploring and walking around, and now we're headed back to our budget motel in the dusk. And it was a hot and sticky night, and my father and I had lagged behind, walking slowly, looking around at the stores and the houses. And there was quite a few local people walking on the sidewalk and in the street, and they were all heading in the same direction with us. Suddenly I realized those people kept turning left at the crosswalk. And when we got to that corner, I saw they had disappeared through a dark tunnel that was covered by foliage. A minute later, a locomotive hurled across the top of that tunnel's walls, and I realized the expression, living on the other side of the tracks, was being played out before my eyes. My dad and I walked a few more steps, and we joined my mother and the other motel guests on the front porch. And from my seat, I continued to watch more people walking through the tunnel. And I could hear the conversation swirling out around me, out from the rocking chairs and into the darkening air. And a shrill woman's voice caught my ear. Can you believe the gall? They tried to stay here with us. The woman went on to explain that a family had tried to book into the motel and had been thankfully turned away. You see, like the people who continued to make their way home through the railroad tunnel, that family was African American. So now I'm going to take everyone back to Queens for a moment. To a Cuban mother's kitchen in Jackson Heights, Queens. I'm a teenager, and I'm spending the afternoon in Jackson Heights, Queens with my Cuban high school friends. We'd gather around the kitchen table in one of the friends' apartments, and her mother was holding court during lunch. No, not royal court, a civil court, where between mouthfuls of sandwiches filled with amazing and mysterious spreads, her mother was peppering me with questions in Spanish. And my friends took turns translating the rapid fire, are you a good student? Are you a good girl? No boyfriends. Working hard? You're going to college. You still hungry? You want more food? The meal took on its own choreography. I would look up when her mother was gesturing to me. I'd smile with that apologetic look of linguistic non-comprehension. And then I'd look to the left for a translation and to give my response. Back to the mother to see her reaction, and then back down at my plate. After a bit, my friend stopped translating, my mother wants to know if you want more food, because it was a pointless question. My plate was being constantly refilled in the good Queen's tradition of eating your way to bonding and cultural awareness. But her mother's emotional comment, I came to this country for a better life for my family, resonated. And it taught me that no matter what language was spoken or food served, all mothers dream and want the best for their children. And now I'm going to take you to a stairwell in the Bronx in the 80s at my college. It was the early 80s. I was sitting at the top of my dorm stairwell with my best male friend. We had been inseparable since our freshman year, and now he had turned into a sullen stranger. He had been irritable for days, alternating between being quietly sullen to muttering terse responses. My questions had rendered nothing until suddenly he began to weep and told me he had something to share with me. He had been hiding for a very long time. And then he was silent. There was nothing. And then I heard me ask a question, as if my voice had tricked my brain into speaking. Are you gay? With one question, our friendship had shifted into new identities. I don't remember saying much after that, but I do remember my thoughts jackrabbiting around about the social implications and being worried. Because you see, in the early 80s, gay pride was just starting to gain public awareness, and it wasn't really talked about, and coming out had carried big risks still. I remember being really quiet, hearing voices, footsteps, doors slamming, while my thoughts raced around and challenged me with questions. So now what happens to our socializing? His family, our friends. What's it all going to mean? But the lesson for me here was sometimes concrete answers are not what are needed or needed, but the simple act of showing up as a friend the next day and the next. And then my final story, which is a lifelong one that started in my 20s, a little lighter, but still has a lot of learning for me. What do you mean you don't have any Irish in you? I am in my 20s, sitting yet at another kitchen table, eating and fielding questions. I was visiting my then new Irish boyfriend, now husband's family in Dublin. We had met in college, and he was now trotting out his American girlfriend and New Yorker new love out to meet the relations. So I'd been sitting in parlors and kitchen tables being scanned and queried as I consumed huge amounts of brown bread, ham and cheese sandwiches, tea biscuits, and the ever-present cups of tea. That's a very unusual last name you have there. How do you say it again? One of his aunts would invariably ask, is it Ukrainian? No, Lithuanian. My family is a blend, Polish and Lithuanian. That's very interesting. I can see the Slavic in you. It's all over your face. But you're no Irish in you. No, unfortunately not a bit. No, but I had Irish nuns in school. Well, that's something. Do you want another ham and cheese sandwich? Go on there, have another. My responses would satisfy the interviewer temporarily until I was handed off to another relation and the whole proceeding would start again. It was as if they were cross-checking my prior responses in the hope that I had mislaid a memory of a relative named Murphy or Farrell. Something. You see, Dublin City and the whole of Ireland was pretty homogeneous back then, and it was common practice for the Irish to vet a fellow Irishman when they met by exploring family names, counties, etc., until they identified a connection, and then they could move forward to have the real chat. So there I sat with my faulty bloodline, a human oddity, someone with no prior ties to their island, and I was being called on to explain me, the entire United States, and what it was like to be a new native New Yorker. But what I could never explain was how it came to be that their first-to-go-to-college relative had gone off to America to attend an Irish-American university in a city with a significant Irish heritage and somehow had managed to find the one person who didn't have any ties to the old sod. So there I sat, with framed pictures of the Pope, Jesus, and JFK smiling back at me as I tried to answer their questions. And in those moments, I was the other. Thank you. Pete, I'd like to open
up. Yeah, thanks, Jules. Thank you. When I first came across your presentation and the title, it caused me to think, because I was thinking, well, the importance of being the other, and I looked at that as from the standpoint of someone in the minority being surrounded by the majority and I was wondering how it would be important for that person to be the other. And then I looked at it from a little different direction. Your last vignette, you found yourself as the other in a different majority, people, a large group of people who weren't like you, that regarded you as an outsider, and the insights that brought to you, and how other folks must feel when they are surrounded by a culture that is not their own. So that was good. That was a great insight. I'm not sure if you intended that, but that's the way I took it. So thank you for that different way of looking at being the outsider.
Thank you. And I definitely have a nonlinear approach to the way I tell stories in the work, but it was about, like, who did I learn from and how important, like, you know, some of these stories was like 40 years ago, and I can still picture them, about what I learned from what, like, my friend, a Haitian friend was experiencing when you're coming and getting swarmed and spending a little time in other people's shoes. And I think that's what I love about the people who do storytelling, the empathy and the learning. But how do we give ourselves and others an opportunity? It's easy to talk to people we like or know, but when we're in uncomfortable situations or new situations, or we haven't met groups and we only know about them from a very slanted media, and how do we start conversations and give people, ourselves, the confidence to take some risks and start talking?
That's I like that, and it raised the question for me, is how do we invite the others into that conversation without putting them on the spot, without somehow overcoming some of the cultural biases we have, which we all do have.
Anybody else wants to chime in? That's great. Well, waiting for the click. I know for me, having sat in Catholic school and lectures, there was a lot of stories I was writing. I was like, we got to get rid of this one. You know, like, we don't have enough time. But I never learned when you're getting yelled at, you know, or you're lectured. You feel bad, and then... But it never really teaches a lot. You know, I knew, like, I wanted to avoid situations if somebody was angry. So it's like the quiet moments, I think, is what we learn from, and how we get up and spend time with people and be patient.
I did like the suggestion you had in one of your online videos that you'd posted that we ought to... find your stoop, a place where you're comfortable talking to people, and maybe that's out of the place of your where you are in power. For example, when I was the ranger, when I was in my office behind my desk, people would be a little intimidated because they wouldn't interrupt, thinking I was working on something very important. But I learned that people would approach me a lot more easily when I ate my lunch in our lunchroom, and that was a time when people would approach me with a lot of different types of conversations.
Yes, definitely. And I've got friends of mine have guided me to always explain the word stoop to people that they may not all know. It's in New York, where we came out of the Dutch heritage, and although everything keeps changing in New York rapidly, for some reason we've hung on some of the Dutch words that existed, you know, in colonial times. And stoep is the word for steps. And in Queens, we still use that, and Brooklyn, too, we use stoop. And it's a French, and it's a memory I have about people sitting on them. And just
my grandmother called it stoop.
Yeah, and front stoop. So you sit there in the evening, and I remember old neighbors across the street with, you know, if after they finish their dinner and their chores, would sit out front in the summer and chit. My guidance is always in work, when I worked in human resources or anything, is find your front stoop that you can sit down and talk with people, like P was describing, where you just hang out and have a conversation that's side by side rather than getting in someone's face and talking to them. So that's my mission of the moment, like creating those moments where people see us differently or maybe change you know, assumption somebody has about us, you know, during our our interaction.
So Tom here, and a question that I'm kind of mulling over in my head is about being the other, and we've been working with an organization that helps people with developmental disabilities find their place in society to just fit in, so that they're not identified by their disability,
mm-hmm.
but by their strengths, which is sometimes hard for me to wrap my head around how you identify someone just from their strengths, and it just kind of seems to me that it's so much better to be identified by your exceptional strengths than your exceptional obvious traits that maybe people see at first.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not exactly sure how to formulate that as a question, but it's just kind of jumping around in my head of
mm-hmm.
how do you describe people, or should you ever describe people? You know, anything there? Click something, a thought for you, Jules?
My first reaction, you said it's jumping around, is more about when those thoughts come in or jump, they're usually the most important thoughts you can be having, and they're there to pay attention to them, I think. Human nature is, we do like to categorize and label. I mean, it's how we describe, and sometimes where we have to catch ourselves is to make sure that, what are we doing with those labels? It's one thing to think it, but how is that translating into action? Certainly. And assumptions, that's the other thing, you know, because sometimes we...
Well, I also think that...
Okay,
hi, this is Cora.
Yes.
I also think that perhaps organizations need to examine that issue of the disabilities. Going back to what you were saying, Pete, I just happened to see a special today on television about the Gaudet University. I may not be pronouncing that right.
Mm-hmm.
It's in Washington, D.C., and
yes.
It's a university for people who are hearing impaired or deaf.
Mm-hmm.
And their football game, I was just amazed by this. At the football game, the cheerleaders sign the American song, they sign the cheers.
Yeah.
All of the players sign to each other out on the field and everything. And not all the players are hearing impaired. Not all the players are deaf. But they just decided that all the players are like learning sign language so that they can talk to each other, even on the football field. I was just like, whoa, this is amazing. So these people are playing football, something that they thought they would never get to do because they're hearing impaired or deaf. and they're getting to play football because they're using sign language. The coaches, everybody is using sign language. It was just like so inspiring that why can't organizations also take disabilities that their employees may have and look at how the organization as a group can learn about those disabilities. So anyway, give it back to you. Just my thought.
What I'm hearing from that is like, how can we, having a disability means, and also making sure we don't make that disability limiting, you know, by
It was just, happened to be this news thing, and it was just like, whoa. You're who? I know, but what is it? Straightening iron.
Cora?
Yes.
Oh.
I'm sorry, my daughter came up and was asking me a question.
Okay.
What was the question?
No,
two questions at once.
That we're trying to prevent things from being limiting. You can have a disability, but to, you know, sometimes it's challenging that we can sometimes put people in the box.
Yes, I agree. But, and I think that's, you know, that's a hard, certainly a hard line to cross.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly something. And so it's something that has to be looked at. That's what I'm saying. That I'm opening this up for conversation, not having an answer. I'm just saying that maybe there's a way an organization can work with that, but I don't have the answer. I'm totally bringing it up for a discussion. Because
no,
I agree with you completely. It can also point fingers at people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're saying. And I agree completely. It's just something that I think organizations need to address. What's that?
Sitting here.
I think that in some of my experience with the Forest Service, at one point we had gotten to gotten with the idea of assigning a mentor to new employees, someone to help explain how things worked and what worked and what didn't. And I think it's the relationship that's important. I think the worst thing you can do is bring in somebody who is the other into your office and say, well, tell me how you think. You know, how are you different than everybody else? And you put them on the spot. And I think it's important to develop a relationship first. Non-threatening types of conversations and gradually let the relationship grow to the point where those conversations can be held without being threatening.
I agree. And also it's having someone to be an advocate and navigate, you know, help that person navigate situations, and especially when somebody is unique to the organization or, you know, they bear a lot of burden to what they're supposed to represent or be. So I think having that person helping them build relationships and also guide them is really important, no matter what.
Hi, this is Tricia speaking. I just joined the call a few minutes ago, and I'm just enjoying the conversation. I just didn't want to be a silent stalker, so I'm on the call.
Welcome.
We heard your ring in. We knew it was you.
There goes somebody else. Hello?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I think it's on my end. Somebody's trying to call in. Sorry about that.
So we were talking about what my overview was about being the other, and I shared some vignettes and memories from childhood ranging from race to seeing segregation to somebody coming out that they was gay to sitting in immigrant kitchens, Cuban friends, you know, getting fed and learning a little bit about that. And then we all share a lot of the same values no matter what our accent is or where we're back from. So it was really about, like, how do we communicate and teach each other about our differences in a good way, in a form that we're not the scary people. Some of it started, I mean, it's always on my mind, but a lot of the talks about immigration and DACA this year and all the complicated things, but, you know, we benefit so much from the immigrants. We all come as immigrants, basically.
Right.
I kept thinking about all the lessons learned I did from being in situations where I had the opportunity to learn from other people about how brave they were, encouraged they were, and, you know, how amazing they symbolized the American dream to me. I remember on election day listening to NPR and the Syrian refugee, he'd been here for many, many years, talking about, you know, you got to work hard in this country, nothing's handed to you, but you can remake yourself and reinvent yourself. And I was like, wow, he's saying so much, and he's had to leave so much behind. And he was a great advertisement for our American dream. And, you know, and so I think I'm always learning from people who are different than me, and I feel like we have to figure out how to have that conversation that's not in somebody's face, but shared learnings, or find where we have the common connections. And that's why I love the work every one of you do, because that's what you're doing every time you tell a story. You're finding that person's voice in the story that you're sharing with them.
It's a great topic.
One thing I wanted to add in here, Tom, here again, is that I've done a lot of work with African Americans. And like when I was growing up in my high school, we had only one African American student. But then in my work, there's been many times that I'm the only Caucasian in the room. And sometimes in a whole, one time I was with like 2,000 people, and I was the only Caucasian.
Wow.
And I think when I'm trying to understand other people's experience, when I get a chance to be the other, it really informs me of how others might feel when they're the one that is different than everyone else. And so when I hear a title like The Importance of Being the Other, it seems like when we reflect on those times when we are the person who stands out, that really helps us to be informed about how other people might feel, and helps us to empathize with them, helps sometimes to be more compassionate or more understanding, or to try to just regularize, make people more comfortable. Just a comment there.
I mean, New York, you have the good fortune, you can choose where you're going to be trying. You could be very segregated in New York too if you wanted to, or easily, but you do get to rub elbows. There's lots of ride the subway, ride the buses, you get exposed to many nationalities, many groups on any given day. But what happens when we don't have those options? You know, we can go through suburban areas around here, and it's very, very different about which roles people take. You know, you can say, well, there is diversity, look at those folks, but what roles do we take, and are we really learning from each other or stopping to have a conversation and humanizing things, getting other people's perspective?
Yeah.
And one of the challenges too is we are because we have these beautiful opportunities with digital and media, that we can really segment ourselves into being exposed to only the things we choose or like. So way back in the dark ages, it was one TV, maybe a couple of stations, and the radio, basically, I think all is of where the radio would play certain set plays, but you would know if you hear a song today exactly where you were standing in 1977 or 1980, because there was a, you know, there was very little variety in the, you know, in the music, but we all shared the common language, or we were watching more of the same shows or things. Now you, with the internet, you have the beauty of choice, but you also don't have as much shared. You can choose not to participate, or you don't have lots of a common areas to cross over from information or news, et cetera. So I find that's a challenge, whether in how is that going to impact learning and an understanding. I mean, we tend to travel more internally in this country with students. You know, traveling overseas is more of a privilege, or it could be a group, where in other locations, like in Europe, it's not that hard to go over and but other nationalities very easily or travel to other countries.
This is Geraldine, a little comment on that, just what you just said, Jules. I was in Belgium a couple of years ago for a conference and had a conversation with the young woman who was waiting on me for breakfast. My mom and I were there. And we were asking her, she was very excited that we were from the United States, and somehow the conversation came up about how many languages she spoke.
Mm-hmm.
And she spoke five.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and she said, if I only spoke Belgian, I would never be able to go anywhere.
Wow.
So it was such an insight for me in terms of that's one of the reasons that travel is a little more easy. I think it's one of the reasons why we see more Europeans here in some ways,
mm-hmm.
because there's a little less of a, if you want to see anything, you have to do something that's different than what you're brought up in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so because, you know, when Belgium is less than the size of Ohio, which we just drove across today, or Illinois, mm-hmm. You know, if you want to see anything else, you better learn something else. So.
Yeah. You know, picking up on that, Geraldine, I was listening to something on NPR, I don't know, earlier this week, and I can't remember the playwright's name. Her first name is Annie, and she's written a couple of plays, and she's being touted as, you know, up and coming. But she's being interviewed, and she did a lot of different jobs, you know, when she was, you know, in school and when she first started writing, and she worked in restaurants, and she worked on The Bachelorette Show. I don't know what she was doing there. And she worked, I don't know, at festivals, and she just had all these odd jobs. And the interviewer said, oh, something like, you know, well, it must be great. You went through all of that, and then now you're a writer. And she said, well, I miss those jobs because once you get known as a writer, you tend to hang out with other writers. And she said, when I was doing all these jobs, I met people I would never have met.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I would never, I forget, whatever her jobs were, and they were like bartender, you know, it was just all this different stuff. But she said, I was just meeting people very different from myself and working with them and learning about them, and I just thought was so interesting. So she was with the other, you know,
mm-hmm.
that was just, you know, quite the experience for her, and then she was able to use that to infuse and inform her writing. So how, and it's sort of like now that she's known, it's a little harder to be able to do that. So I thought that was just, you know, I don't know, really interesting.
And you mentioned NPR jobs, something that was in my memory from this morning. Basically, I was driving to a meeting, and God, NPR is just wonderful. I mean, I just love it. There was a woman being interviewed. So it was an Argentinian film director. She's at Columbia now, and she did a thing on a movie that's coming out, or a documentary about being the other. And it was about somebody from Argentina who didn't fit he was an actor. Like one of the people she showcased was an actor, and saying he didn't fit the stereotype of what somebody from Argentina they thought would look like. So when he was going on auditions, he kept saying, well, I'm Argentinian, I'm Hispanic. So like, you know, but he was blonde, and he looked coloring-wise and everything. So it was, I have to find her last name, and I know she's at Columbia University, so it just kind of intrigued me about the work she's doing. But she used that word, so I thought, oh, that's a sign. It's today. And then until you said it, I forgot because I was sitting around. I know there was something I wanted to bring up.
Well, this is Cora. I think what you were talking about earlier, Trish, was the lack of, you know, 50 years ago, the one television and a radio. But what is true with all of our media is we can use that to help people get to know each other. Because I think one of the things we're talking about is that the more we learn about other people, the more we're able to relate to them. And I think that's part of what we're talking about earlier, and that's when we have experiences that we've had previously, and we look at those experiences and we learn from them because we have learned something that we didn't know before. And so I think even though sometimes the media can be, as you said, difficult because we can turn it off, we can do it any way we want to do it, we can make it not great, but we can also use it, I think, somehow. Mm-hmm. I don't know how people feel about that.
Yeah.
I mean, we do, Corey, you make a good point because there is the opportunity to do what we're doing even today now. Like a few years ago, we never had time to do podcasts or video streams or different creativity. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger people are great about visualizing their experiences, et cetera. So I think you're right. There's a yin and a yang to the things we're using and finding maybe ways to build broader audiences or just find people to share with us as well.
So. Yeah, I think that's just, it's got to be positive to do that, to be able to look at what's happening and what other people are sharing. And I don't know exactly how we use that in organizational and storytelling organization, but I'm sure that there's ways to tell stories about how other people did things that are similar to what you're doing and therefore we can start relating and go, oh, my God, I didn't know that. I don't know if people have heard lately about this new photo journal that's out from the photographer of Obama. Barack Obama had a photographer who followed him everywhere and has just published a brand new book of his photography. You may have heard about it because it's been on the news everywhere. But anyway, one of his favorite pictures was this little boy, African-American boy, who wanted to touch Obama's hair. And he touched his hair, and he's like, oh, you have the same hair as me. Mm-hmm. And it was just like this realization of this little boy is, I have the same hair as the President of the United States of America. And I think that's what so many times we can use that media. We can use all those things that help us learn about each other to learn that we really are the same. Mm-hmm. You know, we really are all the same. We really are just humans.
Yeah.
And so telling stories that let people know that, wow, I've done that, or I was like that, or I had that problem, can help us connect, maybe.
Yeah, it's true. I have a sweet story about a few years back. I have a friend who does a lot of poetry. I mean, I do spoken word and poetry, and I need to practice something I was going to do for a group of women. And it was about my humorous thing was about middle age and waking up in the middle of the night and all the jazz. So I needed a place to practice. So I ended up going to an event where most of the kids were rappers and hip hop, and just like they were talking some tough stories there. And then there's me who trotted up, and I apologize to everyone. So I just need to practice. I need to talk about it. I need to practice this thing before I go out to this audience. And it was the sweetest thing because these guys came up afterwards like, wow, that was so informative. Now I can go home and talk to my mother, and now I understand what's going on.
That's just how sharing stories work, though.
So. I keep thinking, what the hell? I mean, and I was three times their age. And I thought, oh, my God, they're really going to just give me hell at the end. And they were just amazingly funny and helpful, and it was just a great Just
see, that
and
is the power
like,
of story, though.
Yeah. They recognize
that really is
the
power of story, because you could talk to them. You could have gone up there and said, look, guys, I'm really kind of like you guys. I'm pretty much the same. I don't know, whatever. And that's lecturing, and that's not going to work. But there's something about the power of story that can bring us together. And it's it really is, the story really is the power of story.
Yeah, and I was humble because they were sharing. One guy was in a, you know, a home, a foster home, and he, you know, being driven back then, I got impression. The other guy, there was so many things, and I was appalled. It's like, look, I appreciate you guys, and there I am trying to say, like, I just want a full night's sleep. wake up. But it was like one of the best memories of saying, wait a minute, it's up to me to change how I'm showing up and what I'm, you know, bringing with me. And project or making assumptions, because the best moments come out of stuff that made absolutely no sense. You know, when you looked at it, it's like, okay.
Well, and you have to, or you don't have to do anything, but it brings to mind that we can't discount how positively we can affect others in situations where we might think we have no authority or no validity. You know, my sister was at a story slam that was mostly young African-American kids, and one of them got up and he said, my name's Asylum because people all think I'm crazy and I am crazy. And then he did this rap that was really beautiful. And afterwards she went up to him and she said, you know, I want you to know that Asylum has two meanings, has more than just being crazy. It also is a safe place. And then she walked on. And the next one, the whole thing was being organized by a friend of hers. And the next level, this kid had advanced to, and he's there. And he dedicates his piece that day to the white lady who told him that Asylum meant something more. And that she had had such an impact on his life that he was no longer going to describe himself as crazy. She's sitting in the audience crying. Someone says to him, she's here. And he goes out and hugs her, and they end up on the news.
Wow.
And he's gone on to do more. So you never know what kid went home and said, Mom, I understand now.
Yeah.
Or, Mom, can I help you out somehow? And has had some impact that your middle-aged white lady story or, you know, had on them that they will remember, you know, for a long time. We just don't know what power we have, that we're so willing to sometimes, you know, underestimate our power. So I give you big kudos for getting up on a night like that, because I might have chickened out and said, you know, my story's not. But you also gave... Go ahead.
Geraldine, that's an absolutely wonderful story. And we are approaching the end of our hour, and my phone is almost out of battery juice.
Uh-oh.
But at this point, I'm going to stop the recording. And any last thoughts, Jules?
My final thought is to say big thank you to all of you for allowing me to give a speech. And Trish, for giving me an elbow on the ribs, basically to say it was time for me to share some stories.
Did I do that?
Yes, you did.
I'm sure she did
it in a nice way.
Yes, she does. She is very gifted in that way, so I have now learned. But thank you.
All right, I'm going to stop recording now.
Okay.
Well, thanks very much for sharing your ideas, because it certainly generated a lot of